Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author, with Ken Wilber, of Integral Life Practice. Well, today we'll be going deeper in this ongoing exploration of how higher consciousness and spirituality can, in our extreme times, make good on their promise to uplift and change human beings and our whole world. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how spirituality, how the process of awakening to higher levels and states of consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings find the inner resources to rise to the unique challenges of our current world crises so that we can make a transition to a sustainable human presence and a fulfilling one on this beautiful planet. So we've had a series of profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. So this morning, I'm just delighted to be joined in conversation by Dwayne Elgin. The way this is going to work is I'll introduce Dwayne, and then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend the last half hour taking your questions. So we'll be finishing up in about 90 minutes. Our discussion today is entitled Collective Crisis Meets Collective Wisdom. Dwayne Elgin's an internationally recognized thinker, speaker, author, and social visionary. He has an MBA from the Wharton Business School, an MA in economic history from the University of Pennsylvania, an honorary doctor of philosophy for work in ecological and spiritual transformation from the California Institute of Integral Studies. And in 2006, he received the Goi International Peace Award in Japan in recognition of his contribution to a global vision, consciousness, and lifestyle that fosters more sustainable and spiritual culture. His books include The Living Universe, Promise Ahead, Voluntary Simplicity, and Awakening Earth. And with Joseph Campbell and other scholars, he co-authored the book Changing Images of Man. And in addition, he's contributed chapters to 16 other books. He's published more than 70 articles. He's really quite a prolific and original thinker. In the early 70s, he worked as a senior staff member of a joint presidential congressional commission on the American future. And then he worked as a senior social scientist with SRI International, the think tank, where he co-authored numerous long-range futures studies that were quite visionary and significant, especially in those years of the 70s. And over the past 25 years, Dwayne has co-founded three nonprofit organizations concerned with media accountability and citizen empowerment. More than that, what I especially appreciate about Dwayne is that he is a deeply caring, synthetic intelligence, an original thinker, and someone who's really pioneered some important movements. His book, Voluntary Simplicity, arrived long before the movement into voluntary simplicity. His book, Awakening Earth, identified an integral vision that in some ways has a scope comparable to that of Ken Wilber's, and he's really a major integral philosopher in his own right. But he's always done all of this in a very human, dignified, and humble way, you know, really just always with his feet on the ground, level gaze, and a great deal of humanity. So it's with a lot of affection and admiration that, and joy that I welcome you to dialogue with me, Dwayne.
Well, thank you, Terry. That was a wonderful, beautiful caring introduction. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted that we're here now. We've planned this for a few months, and we're finally at the moment of really diving in. And Dwayne, I think you know your thinking ranges pretty widely. We're at a funny moment right here as we're speaking. We've got the first we're in a year in which citizens have taken to the streets in dozens of countries, have actually created regime change in Egypt and Tunisia, and look like they're on the way to doing that in Syria. We have hundreds of people just arrested yesterday on the Brooklyn Bridge in New York City with this Occupy Wall Street moment. And yet we're trying to be very complex thinkers and not just caught in the current pull of events, and yet not pulled back so that we're failing to be responsible citizens in moments of crisis. And as you're with me here right now, even though our topic is broader and more philosophical, we're right in the midst of a hot moment. What arises for you as the most, I don't know, summary or essential thing that you can begin by saying?
Well, I think the kinds of citizen unrest that we're seeing right now from the Middle East and now into the United States, in many ways it's prompted by the economic crisis. Before the uprising in the Middle East, for example, in Egypt the year before that happened, food prices went up in 1 year by almost 50%. And it was the acceleration of those food prices that created a civic crisis that was then catalyzed by the internet and these other technologies into a deep challenge to the regimes. So now look at the United States. Here we are, the middle class is being hollowed out. In many ways, we're being described as a new third world country, and people are protesting. And so we have a similar situation of a profound economic crisis that's being then catalyzed even further by the new generation of technologies, the internet, and so on. Now, stepping back from that, I think that when we look at the global situation, this is just a precursor event to a much larger crisis that is yet to come. My guess is by the 2020s, we are going to be in a world in systems crisis. And by that, I mean not only a financial crisis like we have right now, but by that time, climate disruption, I think, will kick in sufficiently that will impair global food production. Then we're going to have not only a climate crisis, but underneath that, a food crisis. And we will not be able to sustain the populations that are now on, that we're now seeing on the earth. And with that food crisis, we'll then have a civic crisis. And this is then being compounded by the end of cheap oil. And the lack of available energy is also compounding then the economic crisis, and so on and so on. And I could continue on through a number of other indicators, but it suggests to me that what we're seeing right now is just a precursor to a much deeper, much more profound time of challenge and actually transition, in my estimation, to a more hopeful and promising future.
Okay, well, I think when I have these conversations with individuals, one of the things that I notice is that each person who confronts this has a very different individual way of dealing with it. But very often the subtext is, how afraid should I be? How clear can my head be while I'm tending to be so afraid? And what's the hopeful message, and how can I work with this? Very often, the prospect of the we tend to take an awful lot of particularly in the United States and Western Europe and Japan, people tend to feel like a certain level of well-being is there to be taken for granted. The idea food shortages that would affect us is almost unthinkable, and the thought of that it kind of makes the mind unsteady.
That's right.
And here we're having a conversation about how our spiritual practice, how our consciousness, how our way of being human beings can help us rise to the challenge. Obviously, our freak out and our ability not to freak out is maybe the first rampart. please, you know, elaborate on all of that. I'm curious as to how you engage with this, even
right.
personally, frankly.
Right. Well, it's fundamental. I think at the foundation of spiritual practice, at the very beginning of spiritual practice, also therapeutic process as well, is reflection. It's simply being able to sit there and observe oneself, one's life experience, and saying, you know, I just feel awful about this, or I feel great about that. And it's the ability to self-reflect that is so unique to the human experience and is so fundamental to the meditative process. And as individuals, we can sit here and self-reflect, and out of that reflection, we can make considered choices, responsible choices. And not only can we self-reflect individually, if we can do that individually, we can also do that socially. And we have yet to apply our capacity for social self-reflection to the kinds of challenges that we're facing. And what we're doing is we're sitting here passively as a public, waiting for mom and dad, big business, big government, big churches, big media, to take care of this for us. They're not going to do it. They're maintaining the status quo. And if we're going to actually be responsible adults in this situation, we need to claim our spiritual practice of reflective process. Reflect upon our situation and say, hey, I better step up to this because these other institutions are really maintaining the processes, the institutions of the past. And we need to be about creating a new kind of future for ourselves. So going back to your issue of spiritual practice and the capacity for reflection, I think that is fundamental. And it's fundamental not only personally but also collectively for us to begin mobilizing our mass media in a reflective as opposed to a distractive way, to have it reflect upon the challenges that we're actually facing and the opportunities for a new kind of future. And if you look at the mass media, just as a quick aside, the average person watches about 4 hours of television a day. And we are being hypnotized as a culture. There's more than 1 billion person hours of television viewing per day being watched. We are being hypnotized into a culture, into a consumerist mindset that's distracting us from the kind of reflection that would honestly and truthfully tell us what is happening in the larger world. And so, once again, just like when you sit on the cushion and you honestly reflect, we need to sit on the collective cushion here as a civilization, honestly reflect on what's happening, and then make considered choices for the future.
Well, I mean, that sounds right to me, and yet as an individual, I was very politically active during the last presidential election. I was a precinct captain working to elect Obama. But, you know, watching what's going on in the world right now, the rise of the Tea Party, the kind of gridlock that we see in Washington, the ability to reflect as a culture seems so far away from the U.S. populace and even what we see going on right now with the financial crisis in Europe. That democracy is a very messy process, and it does tend to be a little bit of a race to the bottom. What can people be persuaded to become passionate about, rather than what is our highest wisdom? And how is that? You know, we somehow need to be responsible participants right now, not just philosophers kicking back and looking abstractly. To call for a more reflective culture, of course that seems necessary, but how can we enact that?
Well, that's a good question. Now, take a look at Egypt, one of the most oppressive regimes in the Middle East was Egypt under Mubarak, and just incredibly oppressive. And they could be asking the same question, how in the world can we do anything? We're powerless. And yet, at some point, people said, okay, that's it. It's time to step up. And it's not to necessarily object to the status quo. It's to say, we need to move beyond that. And your program, Beyond Awakening. We are awake. Okay, now what? Well, it's time to take a look at these dominant institutions that have been impacting our lives: big business, big government, big churches, big media. And it's time to begin again taking back power in our own lives at the local level and local communities through the mass media, like they've done with the Arab Spring. So we have the media to really transform the consciousness of our culture. We actually do, and it's happened now in the Middle East. But we have yet to have that kind of awakening. Maybe it's beginning to happen with the occupation of Wall Street, but we have yet to have that kind of awakening here in this country.
Well, we do have, you know, we're sitting in a moment right now in which some of our fellow citizens are saying to all of us, including you and me, Duane, this is the moment we have to stand up. We have to say no to the way that corporations are ripping us off hypnotizing us, even though there's been a kind of a media brownout of our demonstrations. We are not going to go away. We just want to build this. And there are now demonstrations in more and more cities all across the country. And we are obviously caring citizens. How should we respond to that call? Is this something that you feel? How do you deal with this? Because for me, let me actually add to the question.
I feel
a little confounded, because I see that the folks involved in the demonstrations, although they're passionate and well-meaning, are not able to comprehend the full complexity of what's before them. Although they're right about many of the, I think, you know, right about many of the points that they're making, there are other aspects of the dynamics of things that they don't know how to account for. They're not really ready to assume the position of power. The demonstrators are not themselves sufficiently complex thinkers or evolved human beings to be able to become the leaders of the world system. And yet, they're enacting the civic role that I think is important. I feel a little compromised. If I join them, I tend to have my own voice dumbed down to the lowest common denominator of what I might have in common with the other demonstrators. And if I don't join them, I continue by implication to support a status quo that is clearly unsustainable. It's something of a dilemma, isn't it?
Well said. I mean, if we choose to do nothing, we are making a choice. And that is to continue along with the status quo, if we choose to do nothing. And so, in a way, we can say, well, here's what I'm against, and I will work on that. Or we can say, well, here's what I'm for, and I'll work for that. And or we can do nothing. And what I'm suggesting is that it's very important at this point to say, well, what are we for? It's fine to say, okay, I'm against what's happened with the banks and the financial institutions and how they seem to have ripped off the middle class of America and so on. But what are we for? Because we are moving into a world and systems crisis, and this financial crisis, for example, the housing crisis, is just going to be one small piece of a much larger crisis when the energy crisis hits and the climate disruption intensifies and so on. And so what I would say is, okay, what we are for are policies for a sustainable earth, for a compassionate way of relating to the rest of the people on the earth and life, and a more sacred relationship with the cosmos. That's what we're for. And we can state that in different ways, but it's a new relationship with the earth, with one another, and with the universe. And it's not very complicated, but around the world, people are saying, well, of course. I mean, that just totally makes sense. We have to have those three elements of sanity brought into our lives, a sustainable earth, a compassionate relationship, and a sacred regard for the universe, if we're actually going to be have a sustainable prosperity here.
Yeah, well, oh no.
Hello?
that's getting my energy these days. Terry?
Dwayne?
Hi, it's Brad, the audio engineer. Terry's going to call back in again.
Okay, good. I think I'm back.
Okay, great.
Yeah, sorry. I'm not at my usual home equipment, everybody, so there may be a little bit of surprise. We seem to have had one just there. Well, Dwayne, I think I heard most of what you just had to say, and I agree. Understanding what it is that we are for is core, and deepening in that, because to you know, my own consideration of what it is that I'm for is in progress. I feel humble. I understand certain things. I understand how important it is. For example, you know, I think that we're at a place now where the influence of money on politics in the United States is it's a critical problem. I understand that there are aspects of the way that corporate ownership of media is hypnotizing people in a different kind of relationship to media, more an expansion of the kind of thing we do have to some degree with public television and public and national public radio. Those things in the United States are important changes. In other countries, I think some similar things with the concentration of power among the super rich and the corporations shifted so that the lives of ordinary people, more people are living at a middle class level where their own interiors can develop, where the progress of the richness of the human experience of life has more room. Those are all things I'm for, but the complexity of working with a group of people, you know, many of the most impassioned people who have taken to the streets are Tea Partiers, who really have a political agenda that's quite inimical to some of the values that I hold. And yet, those are my fellow citizens, and I have to find a way to work with them and live with them in a harmonious way. So my program has to not only represent people like me, but it has to be big enough, capacious enough to hold people very different from me, and to have mechanisms so that we can all come together in a harmonious way so that
yes.
the life of the society can work. And I don't think I've
right.
figured all that out. I don't have a program that's adequate to handle all that. So how are you working with that, the sort of one imperative, which is to understand this well enough that we can make the move in the right direction, and the second imperative is to act. And very often the complexity of what we're facing holds us back from acting. It's like we think, well, God, I need to understand this better, and therefore we're immobilized. And so many
right.
of the most sophisticated, was it the worst are full of passionate intensity and the best lack all conviction? We lack all conviction because we see the complexity and don't know exactly the very best route forward. And yet somehow we're called upon to be engaged citizens despite the fact that we don't have all the answers. How are you working with that, you know, as a very sophisticated and nuanced thinker?
Well, it's. I think you put your finger on it. We're all in this soup together, and we have to work on this together. And if we don't pull together, we're going to pull apart. And if we pull apart, we're in big trouble. And so, our well-being depends upon some kind of transpartisan reconciliation, where we will work together. So, as I look ahead. People say, well, look, the big challenge we face is energy. No, the big challenge is climate. No, it's population, whatever. I say the biggest challenge we face is truth and reconciliation as a species, to tell the truth about what's going on and then to reconcile ourselves with the world we're living in, and then to adapt ourselves to the reality of it. And we're not doing that. We're not telling ourselves the truth about what's happening in the world with regard to climate, and I can just go down the list of different areas, and we're not in a process of deep reconciliation, whether that's the rich and the poor in the world, profound differences, whether it's spiritual or religious reconciliation, men and women, species reconciliation. We're killing off all of these other species. Generational reconciliation, we're consuming it all now. In other words, profound truth. Let's tell the truth here. What's going down? Let's use our mass media to really communicate our way into a truthful, honest understanding and hear from all of these different voices, the Tea Party activists and all the rest, because they have their truth as well. And certainly we can hear their truth. And then in hearing the truth of everyone, we can begin then to reconcile ourselves. Well, that's true. That's what's going on. And given that truth, we can then move ahead with clarity, with confidence, instead of the confusion and fantasy and complexity that we have right now. Because I think it's a fairly simple situation. We're running out of resources, basically. And resources for food and energy and so on. And we have to figure out new ways of living. And we're really good at being inventive as a human family. And we can do that. And this will be really creative and an exciting time. But we have to step up and get on with this. And so one of the key things is for citizens to say, look, one of the biggest things I can do is simply talk. You know, it was our ability to communicate that got us here as a human family. And it's going to be our ability to communicate that will get us into a sustainable, happy global civilization. And so just begin the conversation with family, with friends, with workers, and so on about this whole circumstance that we're finding ourselves in, this great turning from separation to now connection as a human family, and begin to tell what we think is the story of that process. Because what we have is a bunch of facts, but not a lot of story, really to give a frame for those facts to really understand where it is that we're going. But if we said, for example, hey, look, we're just growing up as a human family. We're just moving from our adolescence and moving through that difficult rite of passage called adolescence and moving into our early adulthood. And people, the lights go on. People say, I see what's happening. We're just growing up. Let's cut ourselves a little slack. Let's encourage ourselves. Let's move beyond the parental institutions of big business, big government, and so on. Let's take freedom into our lives. Let's build ourselves lives that really have meaning and happiness for us down to local level and mindful of the global, and so on. So I see a process, Terry, at work that we're people are beginning to empower themselves, just beginning to empower themselves. And they're beginning to say, we own the airwaves, actually. You're just leasing it. We actually own the airwaves. And money in politics is actually the money that goes into media, buying airtime and such. And we own the media, and we're going to create a new media that talks about things that matter. So my bottom line is that as a society, if we want a new future, if we want a new capacity for communication and so on and so on, boy, we can really, really have it. And so it's up to us. It's our future and it's our choice. And I'm here to be a cheerleader for evolution.
Well, gosh, there are so many provocative things that you've just said. I feel different voices within me are impatiently wanting me to respond in three or four different directions. But let me respond especially to this idea of having a clear narrative, a story that makes sense in a larger way. And the story that you just suggested, I know, is one that you've contemplated and kind of tested with audiences all over the world. And when you've told me in the past, when you've asked people, what do you think? Is the human species in its childhood or its adolescence or its adulthood or its old age? almost everybody all over the world says adolescence, adolescence.
Yep.
It's like we all intuitively recognize that. And so it's a very powerful narrative. But as a complex integral thinker, you've not only looked at that narrative, you've looked at the process of building narratives, and you've identified maybe a dozen, but especially, you know, seven or eight, and particularly four that you think are worth us all thinking about. And I'd like to invite you to at least give us an overview of that whole process of building narrative, and that this idea that maybe we're moving into our adulthood, although you think it's very powerful and in a fundamental way revealing and true, it's not the only way to look at it.
Right. Let's look at this for a minute. You know, we as humans kind of go about our lives, and we have these unspoken narratives that guide us. Might have come from our parents, but often it's from the media and the culture and so on. And the American dream of money gives you an opportunity to lead a happy, fulfilled life. The American dream is turning into the world's nightmare with climate disruption and so on and other impacts from just unsustainable consumption. And basically, what we have is a story that doesn't work anymore. And so people are confused. They're saying, okay, we have set up these institutions and all the rest around the story of affluence as a source of purpose and meaning, and it's not working. And so what we need to do as a society is to say, well, look, what story does work? What story gives meaning? Where is purpose and aliveness in our life and so on that we are really engaged by and so on? And so what I've done over the last 40 years is look for those deep narratives, those deep stories that really engage people, and narratives that are simple. And, for example, the one we just talked about, humanity growing up, I've asked that around the world. People instantly recognize that as a narrative, as a story that really relates to the whole human experience. So it needs to be simple. It needs to be emotionally powerful. When people talk about growing up, boy, it really connects with their own life experience, and it has a strong emotional feeling. And it needs to be evocative of their higher human potentials. And we think about growing up and into our adulthood, and there's our freedom to explore in whole new ways. So there are these core stories, simple.
Uh-oh. Okay, you're back?
Yes.
Okay, we lost you for just a split second. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Where did you... I'll happily go back?
No, it was just literally a couple seconds.
Okay, great. So there are stories that are a powerful alternative to the American dream that a lot of people relate to, and it's not just the American dream, it's humanity's dream. And humanity's dream could be, well, hey, we're just growing up. And what we're doing in growing up is learning how to live sustainably on the earth and compassionately with one another and with a sacred regard for the universe that's our larger home. Now, other stories that you asked about, a second one that many people recognize comes from Joseph Campbell. He had one called The Hero's Journey. And The Hero's Journey has three aspects. The hero goes through a time of separation, then initiation, and finally return. Separation, initiation, return. And I ask people, well, if you look at the human family, where are we? Are we on a path of separation, differentiation from one another? Are we in a time of initiation or a time of return? And around the world, people say, wow, we are in a time of initiation. We are colliding with one another as cultures, as civilizations, as people. We are in a time of initiation, and it will take a heroic leap.
Dwayne?
Hello, Japan Beauty Clinic.
We have a funny thing with Dwayne's connection, don't we? I think we'll have him back in just a moment, though, if our past interruptions are our guide.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. You were saying the initiation being a time of heroic a heroic opportunity, and then we had an interruption of your line.
Yes. So it will be a time of just a heroic opportunity, and that's what we're looking at, I think, right now. It's to go through that truth and reconciliation process. Once we see the truth of what our situation is, opportunities that were not apparent to us will become so. So anyway, that's the second story that we could draw upon as a human family, that to say we're not villains here ruining the earth. We're actually heroes. We're on a heroic journey, a heroic journey of awakening, and that then brings me to the third story. And this story comes then from science. And science says who we are as a human family, as a species. We have a specific name. It's called Homo sapiens sapiens. And technically, we're not Homo sapiens. We're Homo sapiens sapiens. And that means not only are we wise, we're doubly wise. Not only do we know that we know. And where animals know that we know. And knowing that we know, we have a capacity for reflective consciousness. We can see ourselves. We can observe ourselves. We can take responsibility for our actions. We can think about our actions. And that capacity for self-recognition leads to then to an appreciation of the universe in a whole new way. And so that's another story. And we can say, well, look, we're just learning how to become more reflective as a human family. And our mass media, the cybersphere, is the technology that we're using to uplevel our capacity for collective reflective consciousness. And as we become collectively reflective, we will reflect upon what's happening with climate and species extinction and all the rest, and we will create a more habitable future for ourselves. So that's a third major story, and it interfaces then with our with the internet and the cybersphere. And the last major story, story number four, is recognizing that the universe is itself a unique kind of living system, and we are a part of that living system. So we're more than just biological beings. We are also what we might call biocosmic beings. And so in addition to our biological identity, we have a cosmic dimension or extension of ourselves, and we begin to explore and identify that aspect of ourselves. And that would then be a part of our story as a human family, evolving our sense of identity from primarily biological identification to seeing ourselves as a part of the aliveness of a living universe.
Mm. Yeah. Well, this is, I think, one of the most beautiful. Well, there are many particularly beautiful, but this is one of the aspects of your original work that I particularly appreciate and admire, is this looking at narrative. And I know that you've identified even others, and you've thought about which of these narratives is appropriate for certain people or certain groups of people at certain times and when dealing with certain kinds of challenges. And I want to just offer to the folks who are listening that we'll be making announcements about Duane's website, duaneelgin.com. You can identify more of his writings, and there are videos and e-books and so forth. But this particular aspect of your work is there a particular place that you'd refer people to if they're interested in these different narratives, Duane?
Golly, we're working on a website right now that will will be only about these narratives.
Mm.
Stories of great transition for the human family, and we're developing a description of 8 different stories that come from a variety of sources, from cosmology, from biology, from living systems, and so on. And what we're saying, there isn't a single story. There's an ecology of narratives, and you can pick and choose whatever narratives really work for you, but these narratives actually tell a rather similar story, and they can weave together to tell what I think is called the great story, or the story of the great transition of the human family. So that's something I'm working on right now, but we do not have the website up yet, but we will soon. But people can look to my website, DwayneElgin.com, and there will be a description there for connecting with it.
Okay. Well, this seems to me, you know, for those of us who are inspired by all of this in a way that has us engaging with others and teaching or just engaging in conversation and in really trying to raise the consciousness of people around us, some of these key stories, the story of humanity growing up, the story, you know, of humanity going through its adolescence, humanity going through its own hero's journey, the story of us becoming a biocosmic species, the story of us waking up and taking a kind of mature responsibility, merging from our old myths into a new self-aware, awake kind of stance. These are really powerful and valuable, and I think this is one of the gifts that you give us in a unique way. One of the things, though, that I want to do in these conversations, and I kind of began this conversation by prodding you in that direction, is to press us into the questions that we haven't got good answers for yet. And as much as you've contemplated and deeply had insight into, I think there's a, as these crises become hot, the demand for us to act, you know, increases. We have learned, and it's an interesting paradox for me, is I've had a lot of dialogues, and the folks who've listened to multiple Beyond Awakening sessions know that I've had conversations with people who don't even necessarily acknowledge that we're in an unprecedented moment of crisis, who say, well, you know, human beings have always been facing life and death crises in every age, and they've always had a unique characteristic, and this one's unique too, but why, you know, isn't there something a little grandiose or you know, inflated, imagining that this one is different from all the others? Everybody thought theirs was the most important at every moment, so why is this different? They might also say the most important thing simply to be true, to awaken from your dream of separation, to become a conscious and simply present, open-hearted, loving human being. The eternal spiritual truths are the point. I hear in you a different perspective, one that is deeply spiritual, but which is also grounded in action. And one of the definitions of an integral vision is one that is both able to awaken from the dream, but also able to be a force of awakening within the dream. That is, that even though we might be dreaming our stories, that we can dream bad dreams or good dreams, like you said, the American dream becoming the world's nightmare. And it's important that we change that dream. And this calls to mind this history of just a generation before, when during World War II, certain intellectuals who were very profound failed to take a moral stand against the Third Reich and cooperated with it, like Heidegger, whereas others really saw that there was a moral stand that their philosophy implied, and they were active. People like Bonhoeffer, who's really a great hero, although he did perish for his moral stand. And I think that I do not want to be an armchair integral philosopher who can say profound things about a lot of things, but when push comes to shove, I fail to respond to the moral crisis of my time. And I know you similarly care. And as things heat up, we may be called upon to be active, to take a stand or not, you know, not to be drawn foolishly into the yammering babble of anxious points of view when it's inappropriate, but not to simply sit back all the time. And how do you discriminate? How do you understand when to be the kind of practitioner who rises above the contending points of view and when it's important to step in? And, you know, it matters, for instance, whether it would have mattered a lot if Gore had been elected rather than Bush in 2000, you know, and when is it important to lean in as a citizen and be active? And when is it important to kick back and see a bigger picture?
Mm-hmm. Well, for myself, I decided in 1976 it was time to lean in. And so I've been freelancing for transformation ever since. And as far as I'm concerned, it's all hands on deck right now, right now. I mean it. We are in far deeper trouble as a species than we recognize, because there are lag times built into these driving trends like climate and so on. Climate takes about 20 years to really show up in terms of change after we've actually introduced the greenhouse gases and so on. So it's time to have all hands on deck, as far as I'm concerned. And it's way past time. And to me, that means, first of all, talking about what's going on. It doesn't mean that we agree about what's going on, but we at least put it on the radar screen of public conversation, private and public conversation, and in our homes and in our workplaces and so on. We at least acknowledge what's going on. And then secondly, if we really care about this, we can then begin to respond to it. And people say, well, what can I do? I'm powerless. But actually, it's the individual that has the most power to make the biggest difference. And the biggest difference are when you accumulate over millions and now billions of people small changes. And so it's the work that we do, it's the food that we eat, it's the clothes that we wear, the car that we drive, the house in which we live, and so on. And as a whole bunch of changes in our lives accumulate into an extraordinary avalanche or wave of potential change. So we actually have great power in our very personal lives to impact the whole if those lives are then accumulated into a collective intention. And we can get that in collective intention through our talking or communication with others. And then beyond that, beyond our personal lives, we can look into our collective lives and we can say, well, look, one of the most powerful things that we can do is talk to one another. Let's begin to use our mass media in ways that really serve the public interest, because that is the law. That's what the law says for broadcast television, is that it's supposed to be used to serve the public interest. Well, let's ask for that as a public, because we're just wimping out as a public. We're a passive public. And so it's time to be actively engaged in requesting what's legally and legitimately ours, and that is the ability to communicate as a public. So my point is, we can do a lot in our very personal lives as well as in our public lives to begin a process, a legitimate process that's inclusive process, that's respectful, and that will be a transformative process, because it begins the process of telling the truth what's going on, and let's reconcile ourselves to the reality of the different points of view and processes that that embraces.
Okay, good. Well, there are things that we can do. One of the things that might be most highly leveraged would be if we could build a large enough, passionate enough, engaged enough movement to demand some specific changes in the way that governmental ownership of the airwaves is administered, such that we might have different kinds of messages coming out on TV in a different way. People would not want to have their choices curtailed, though. We would, at best, maybe have a publicly financed additional channel or two or three or four. And those channels would then be having to compete with the very well-financed commercial channels that already exist, that are very attention-grabbing and use all kinds of signals that trigger our inbuilt biological urges, so that, you know, sex and threat and quick cuts that stimulate our visual orienting response and all kinds of things grab attention. And they're reverse engineered to be the most attention grabbing things that they could possibly be. We wouldn't, how would we have an alternative communication medium that would be able to compete with those interests effectively? And is this, and this is really restricted to the U.S., incidentally. We have a lot of listeners from other countries right now, and particularly to our downloads. Is that you know, is that the issue we should all focus on? And if we all focus on that, then do we fail to focus on other key issues like climate change? Personally, as an activist, I'm not clear as to how to invest my energies. When I look at the larger challenges, it seems to me that we are called upon to be active on many issues, and the systemic forces that tend to make it hard for citizens to assert power mean that we kind of would have to concentrate on one or two issues in order to be effective. And frankly, I don't see one or two issues that encompass the full complexity of the crises that we face. So how do you understand that? How do you untie that Gordian knot and liberate your own impulse to make a concrete difference, you know, right here, right now?
Great questions. Okay, first of all, this is crucially important for people to understand, because most people do not actually understand this, and it is that the public in the United States owns the airwaves, period. The public owns the airwaves. And they own the airwaves not nationally, but rather at the local level, at the community level. And that means the folks in San Francisco or Seattle or Chicago and so on, it's at that scale where the television station has a reach that embraces Chicago or Seattle or San Francisco. It's at that scale that the public owns the airwaves. And this is unequivocal, their ownership. And the ownership means that television stations, broadcast television stations, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, those four, they have a strict legal requirement to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And this is written in the communications law going back to 1928. And anytime the public wants to walk into a television station and say, we want programming that serves the public interest, convenience, and necessity, and here's what it is, at that point, the television station has an obligation to serve that. And if television is not serving us, it's entirely our fault as a public. And if we walk into the television stations as a transpartisan public, rich and poor, business and labor, a diverse community, we get access to the airwaves. And with access to the airwaves, we can talk not only with 30 people or 300,000 people, we can talk with millions of people at a time. And that is the issue, then, in my mind, that encompasses the complexity of all of these other issues. Because if we can talk as a community, and we can say, well, how do you feel 1 month about policies about climate change or about bank reform or about this or that, and just get the sentiments of the public with scientific polling of the public, that's going to transform the conversation of democracy and the consciousness of democracy. And it's a very simple process. It empowers the public, and it appreciates that the public has a lot more savvy and sensibility, intelligence, than just holding up a sign to protest. It can actually vote and appreciate and respond to its different points of view. So we are on the verge, I feel, of a transformation of the political process by virtue of the public saying it's time to take back the airwaves and these other tools of communication, similar to what's happened maybe with the Arab Spring, but unique to the United States, to the American experience. And we're going to have a new level of conversation as a democracy, and that in turn is really up-leveling the reflective capacity, the self-reflective capacity of democracy.
So you would focus on this particular issue, and you would say that you'd encourage people to do that in their local communities. So in the United States, that would be the issue. However, we have a lot of listeners from other countries, and we have these huge issues, like the climate change is a huge issue, and these, you know, transitions to sustainability are huge issues. Money politics in the United States is a huge issue in most countries. You still would prioritize this matter of taking control of the airwaves as the form of activism that you would see as most high leverage.
Most powerful, yeah.
And in another country,
yep.
that might not be the same. You know, we have questions here from someone in Argentina, someone in Slovenia.
Yeah.
How would you address them when this is not necessarily their situation?
Right. What we're talking about is the politics of consciousness. The politics of consciousness. And in other words, we're talking about the consciousness of individuals connecting with many other individuals. And looking at the Arab Spring, it was the consciousness of individuals in their cell phones and such, connecting with the consciousness of other individuals through the internet and such. And so you had literally the politics of consciousness expressing itself through this new media. And what I am saying is that if we genuinely want a new world, we need both a new story. So I'm emphasizing it's very important to be talking about story. And we need a new story machine, those two things. New story and a new story machine.
We're having another one of those interruptions, Duane. We're hearing a dial tone. I think you're still connected, but there's something odd that has happened periodically. Okay, good. You're back.
Okay. So we need both a new story and a new story machine. And I'm not wanting to overemphasize, let's say, taking back the airwaves and the politics of consciousness in that way. That's really important because all of these issues of climate change, species extinction, running out of cheap oil, alternative energy, and all the rest, we need to talk about those as a public. And if we can talk as a public, we can move ahead politically with agreements and move ahead with our future. But underlying all of these critical issues is the critical need for communication. So I'm saying in the spirit of a politics of consciousness is a politics of media that really brings a self-reflective consciousness into our process of communication as a society.
Well, this is so rich, Duane. Thank you very much. I'm ready to charge ahead in three more different directions, but I know that many of the people who are listening have already typed in some really interesting questions, and I have a few important announcements. So if you have a question for Duane or me, you can, if you're listening via your computer, you can do as many have already done and type your question into the instant teleseminar window that you see on your browser. If you've dialed in by telephone, we can hear you live if you press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And I see somebody already has, probably a regular listener who knows the code, star 2. I'd also want to mention again that if you want to find out more about Duane's work, you can go to duaneelgin.com, DuaneElgin.com, and you can find out more about him and read a number of his articles. He also blogs regularly on the Huffington Post, has some really excellent recent columns that are available there. I also want to tell you one of our sponsors with which I'm also associated is Bay Area Integral, and Bay Area Integral has a number of upcoming events I want to let you know about, a couple of them involving me. On Saturday, October 15th, in a little less than 2 weeks, in Berkeley, California, there'll be a seminar from 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Featuring myself and Ken Wilber, who will be engaging in a dialogue live. It's called The Evolution of Integral Inquiry, and it's I think $60 for the general public and $50 for students. So you're welcome to go to that, and hope many of you will. Michael Dowd, who was a guest on this series, will be speaking on the evening of November 8th. And Bay Area Integral asks you to look at your calendar and consider attending a weekend seminar December 16th through 18th. Diane Hamilton, Diane Musho Hamilton, Zen Sensei and integral teacher. She and I will be co-leading a weekend workshop December 16th through 18th, also in Berkeley, California. It'll be called The Impossible Practice of Relationships, How the Integral Map Can Help. That'll be Friday evening, all day Saturday and Sunday until mid-afternoon. You can find out more about all these events at BayAreaIntegral.com. And I also want to let you know that my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, will be relaunching in just a few weeks. It's a really rich program that can help take you step by step through the process of engaging in integral practice as a spiritual practitioner, as an activist. One of the things that I've seen is that we are the instrument, and we can only be effective and we can only be clear to the degree that we are actively practicing. And that practice is a whole life of practice in which life practices you effectively, but it has to be embodied every day through a daily practice. And that daily practice is not just a spiritual, so-called spiritual practice, it's an integral practice that involves your mind, your emotions, your soul, your physical body, your civic relationships with others in your community and in the world, and that integral approach to practice, one that's deeply self-compassionate but also really self-transcending and having a higher view, is really rare. It tends to seem like people have to choose between joining cults on one hand, or on the other, hanging out in profane popular culture where the sacred never really gets enough traction to break them through to another level of awareness. And so it's been just so gratifying to have been able to develop an online course that takes a sincere person who's willing to take up a daily practice just through 8 sessions to a whole new phase of life and consciousness. So this is an eminently doable, not overly ambitious step-by-step process that takes you from being a seeker to really being a practitioner in an integral sense. You can find out more about that soon. We're going to actually reconfigure the way we describe it, but the language that advertises the program as it has been offered is at theispcommunity.com, theispcommunity.com. That's Integral Spiritual Practice, so you can take a look at that. And also, please stay on the line, and after the questions and answers, I'll tell you a little more about our upcoming events with Dr. Daniel Siegel and Bruce Lipton and others. So, okay, let's get into the question and answer section of the broadcast today. Again, you can press *2 if you want to raise your hand, and you can type in your questions if you're listening by computer. Okay, we have quite a few really interesting questions that have been asked, Duane. One of them, I think, is very direct and probably good to begin with. Sherry from Chicago says, "Duane, you speak of reconciliation. How do you reconcile with intolerance, who design for failure of you and society without concern or compassion for diverse points of view?" We're having
Jenny, can't come to the phone.
Having
message.
A slight interruption of your line, Duane. I think it'll come right back as it has before. Still can't hear you, but I think it'll be only momentary.
Re-record your message. Press 1. Discard your message. Press 2. Mark your message urgent. Press 3.
Okay, well, folks, if you're hearing what I'm hearing, it's a little odd, but
send your message.
If history is any guide to the future, we should be hearing Duane come right back on in just a moment.
Your message has been sent.
It was my line.
There you go. Now we hear you, Duane.
Okay, good. Responding to Sherry's question, reconciling with intolerance, and if we look at what's happening in the world, that's such a powerful question, because we have 3 different major paradigms competing with one another for domination, actually. One is the agrarian point of view. It's a more fundamentalist perspective. I grew up on a farm. I really have a feeling for this. The more agrarian, fundamentalist, stable kind of mindset. Another mindset is that of the industrial era.
Oh, gosh, Dwayne, it looks like you've gotten interrupted again. We heard you say the mindset of the industrial era. And,
okay.
Now that you're back. Good.
Okay, doggone it. So the mindset of the industrial era is much more dynamic, but it's thought-oriented, has a thought kind of orientation and materialistic orientation. And now we are moving deep into the communications era. And that has a different kind of consciousness that goes with it, that moves beyond the materialism. And it contextualizes both the agrarian and the industrial. And so we have these three paradigms, these three views of ways of looking at reality that are dominant in the world right now. And they're trying to find some reconciliation. And so what Sherry said, how do you reconcile with intolerance? Because these paradigms are not necessarily very tolerant of one another. And so one of the first things that we need to do is simply to tell the truth. And to tell the truth and have that be brought into the healing court of public opinion, if you will. And Martin Luther King said it was the darkness of inattention, the lack of public opinion that allowed these kinds of hatreds to fester in human experience. And by bringing them into the healing light of public attention, we can begin to heal the divisions that are just so powerful in our world. So I really want to acknowledge the truth in what she's saying and the power of a new kind of politics of media to be a healing force for transformation, for reconciliation.
Okay, so when I'm face to face with that intolerant, what do I do? I mean, don't we sometimes simply need to fight and win?
I cannot answer that without. I just don't have a specific response. Fight and win. It seems like what is required is to integrate and transform, to be inclusive, and to find the synergy, the energy in that inclusiveness. Otherwise, if we pull apart in conflict, my guess is we're gonna veer off into a new dark age as a human family, and it could take generations, many generations, to really create the ecological foundations for a sustainable future. So this is really an important time to create a more compassionate foundation, so we can create the biosphere basis for a promising future.
Well, I'm so sympathetic with everything you're saying, Dwayne, and I guess what I meant to articulate is there's an idea in game theory that sometimes the guy who is craziest has the advantage. The guy who's willing to self-destruct and destroy everybody else has the trump card, because the person who's trying to be reasonable is constrained in their options, whereas if the person that you're over against is playing a kind of all or nothing game and doesn't care if everybody's, you know, I don't care if we go into a new dark age, we're going to, you know, my way or the highway, the kind of way that
right.
Republicans, kind of the stance that the House Republicans took in the recent debt ceiling negotiation with Obama. So there's an argument that always trying to reach reconciliation, you know, according to game theory, puts you at a disadvantage, and therefore you have to sometimes fight and win. I'm not sure that I'm not demanding that you have an elegant answer to this, but it's one that confounds me. I always am trying to look for that which transcends and includes all
right.
polarities and really opens a ground for everyone to come together. But sometimes it seems as though you do have to fight and win, otherwise the tyranny of that dynamic in game theory is going to prevail.
Well, let's apply that to this situation. Here's how it looks to me. that that politics is in stalemate, and the way to transform that stalemate is to move that politics into a more adult sphere, if you will. This is juvenile, I think, what's going on. Here, someone characterized, I just saw, you know, humor through the internet. It was the Republicans and Democrats arguing over the debt limit was like a drunkard arguing over where to put the deck chairs on the, or how to pay the bar bill on the Titanic. That we are not paying attention. This ship is going down while we're arguing about things, and that we're not stepping up to the actual challenges and opportunities of the situation. And that, in turn, is why I am asking for an empowered public to step beyond the politics of tradition, if you will, which allows these people to control our lives. And it's to say, let's take our lives back, and let's take the media back, and let's take the airwaves back, and let's take the conversation back, let's take the story back, let's take the future back. Let's tell them what we want, and then they can be effective leaders. And let's hold them accountable in the court of public opinion on a regular basis, not just once every 4 years, but every week, every month. Let's have these electronic town meetings locally. Let's have them nationally. Let's have them globally. And with that kind of empowered public, I am completely confident that we're going to have we could quickly have a shift into a new kind of future.
Well, terrific, Dwayne. Thank you.
Sure.
I want to let some others ask questions. I feel like I could be dialoguing with you all day. here's a question from someone calling in from a area code 941 telephone. Here you go. I think I've opened up your line. Please introduce yourself. Hello?
I think it's me. I'm not sure. Thinking, am I the only one from 941?
You're on the air. What's your name?
Okay. Joni Lawrence.
Hi, Joni. What's your question?
Yesterday in New York City, there was a 24-hour conference on mindfulness. And, I've been exposed to that before, and it seems like that's somewhat of a, at least growing, grassroots movement in that, you know, let's change how we treat each other. And of course, a big word is compassion, and I always like to throw in respect. And do you feel that that at least would be a start for people to start to communicate and not be so isolated from one another and separate? And from there, we could jump into bigger movements, or do you think it's just way too sort of passive and subtle?
Oh, wonderful question, Joni. Yes, mindfulness as a practice, if you look on Huffington Post, for example, it's commonplace to see articles about mindfulness, about living more consciously. And we're talking about essentially cultivating the capacity for reflection, personally and socially. And so absolutely there is a grassroots movement in this country where it's gone from the periphery and the margins to now it's in the mainstream, and you'll hear from Oprah Winfrey and others talking about mindfulness, meditation, and reflection, and so on. So you're right. It is a grassroots movement, and there is a foundation of compassion and respect in that capacity for reflection. And so it is a place to start from. And not only is it a place to start from, if you look at the surveys, we as a country have really transformed our sense of who we are, our relationship to the universe, but we have not allowed the mass media has not been telling us that. And let me give you just a quick statistic to show that. In 1962, 22% of the American adult population said, yes, I've had a mystical experience, a profound sense of connection with a living universe, let's say. 22%. Now we go forward year by year by year, and that's grown from 22% to now in the United States it's 49%. It's more than doubled in roughly half a century. And it means that as a public, half of the American public has had the feeling of deep communion and deep peace and love and connection with a living universe. And so mindfulness as a practice allows us to reflect upon these deeper experiences that we commonly share. And so absolutely it is a starting place and a place for us to grow from. And so in the politics of consciousness, mindfulness practice, capacity for reflection, I think is fundamental to our future.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
I want to get in some more questions. We've got quite a few that people have typed in, Duane. Anna from Slovenia asks, couldn't the problem be also that there is a different truth in different stages of evolution right now in the world, and that there isn't a chance for the lowest to catch up with the highest before it is too late?
Well, we live in a world of extraordinary interdependence. And in small ways, individuals can make the whole thing just a mess, if you will. And so it's going to be critical for us, whether it's, how is it put, the highest, the lowest, we're all in this together. And if there's one truth, it's that we need, first of all, a sustainable Earth. And the Earth, given our present track, is not sustainable. And so that's a truth that we all share. If there's another truth that we all share, is that we have to live together compassionately, because if we don't, it only takes a small number of people to really disrupt the well-being of the Earth for everyone else. So that is another truth, to live together compassionately. And a third truth is that, in my opinion, not everyone shares this, a third truth is that we all share a reverential regard for the universe, our deepest home. And whether we grew up on a farm, as I did, or in a city or whatever, we all share that that truth as well. So, Anna, I feel that there are some things that we share just by virtue of being human beings, and we can respect that we share those things, even though our life circumstances may be very, very different, and we need to respect those differences. And I'm not trying to gloss over those differences, so I want to respect that. But I also want to say that there are some deep truths that we need to come to in truth and reconciliation as a human family if we're going to live together peacefully and create a future of sustainable prosperity.
Beautiful. Beautiful. There is a great deal of diversity among these questions that we've got. For instance, a fellow named Thomas Woodard from Laredo asked a couple of questions. One is, I think it's important to make discipline distinctions between corporate profits taking advantage of us all, which is clearly a major oversimplification, and belies what we may need from the technology of corporations. A great example of that is we're here listening on a technology that didn't exist 10 years ago. And then he goes on and says, what do you see as the inevitable effects of worldwide economic globalization on the stresses that we're experiencing today personally and as a community? And then he says, what about the non-sponsored, serious scientists that do not believe that anthropogenic global warming is actually the case and that this is more of a politicized issue than good science? So he kind of tags together three different questions. Would you like to respond to Thomas?
Well, let me start with the last, global warming, which I think is not a good description. It should be global climate disruption. And I grew up on a farm, and I saw that in the springtime, if we had 2 weeks of extra rain in the springtime, we were in trouble because we couldn't plant. And if we couldn't plant, that meant our harvest would be pushed a few weeks late in the fall. And if we were pushed a few weeks late in the fall, and if a frost came, it would either kill the crops or it would freeze them in the ground. And what most people don't realize, not growing up on farms, is how delicate, how fragile the food growing system actually is. And it doesn't require melting the ice caps to have a real mess. All it requires is to disrupt the predictability of climate by just a matter of weeks in the springtime and rain, let's say, in the summer and harvest in the fall. Just a few little bit of disruption, and you have big problems. And we are already up against the limits of the Earth to sustain a population of 7 billion people, tripled since I was born. So my sense is that we're moving into a time of global climate disruption. That disruption, in turn, will be seen as the inability to produce food so predictably, and with that, we're going to see food crises, and with that, we're going to see civic disruption, and with that, a cascade of real consequence. So I take this very seriously, and I recognize that there are about 11 different variables moving together simultaneously to create what would be considered climate change. And so I'm not trying to simplify this. This is a very complex process, but I take it very seriously what the consequences of it might be. And then the other questions, Terry.
Well, economic, kind of kind of disputing some of the typical progressive political formulations, the idea of corporations taking advantage of us all, but in a way we've benefited from, you know, we have communicating on technologies that were developed
right
by corporations, so we're the beneficiaries of this.
Absolutely.
Sometimes flawed system.
We are. And I want to emphasize, I do have an MBA from the Wharton Business School, so I'm not anti-business. I really appreciate the role of business. And my feeling is that business is obviously the engine of material change, and if there's anything that we need a profound green revolution, in my estimation, which is the most remarkable opportunity for business that it's ever seen in the history of the world. We have roughly half, two-thirds, three-quarters of the planet that's living essentially in poverty. And if we can create a feeling of hope and opportunity for the impoverished billions of this earth, we have a future of promise for the earth. But if we don't at least acknowledge truthfully the existence of the impoverished billions of the earth and some hope that they can transform their lives, we are building the conditions of terrorism, and we're never going to have a peaceful, happy world under those circumstances. So I am not against business. I'm just saying let's expand the role of business, have a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of community connection for business. And so its deeper, bigger role can actually be honored in our new future.
Okay, good. Thanks. There are quite a few questions here. I want to get to a few of them. Nancy Doyle from Charlotte says, I feel so much of what is being said is feeding the emotion of fear. If we want to awaken, why can't we come to this from a place of visualizing positive changes? Like instead of a lack of food, why not picture an abundance of food for all? That brings a much higher vibration to my spirit than picturing people starving.
Well, wonderful. And Nancy, what I've been working on are those positive descriptions of the future. And these eight different narratives that we've been working on that come from biology and cosmology and so on, like humanity growing up, coming out of psychology and such, that's a very positive view of the future, but it acknowledges that we're in our adolescence, and most people recognize that, for example, in their adolescence, they went through the fire of initiation to grow into their adulthood. So it's not to induce fear, but it's rather to say, hey, look, this is not an easy process. Let's be honest about this, and let's acknowledge that it is a challenging process, but you're going somewhere. You're going to move through this. You're going to move beyond the rite of passage of adolescence and into your early adulthood. You're then going to have freedom. and you're going to have the freedom to greet your life in a way that you didn't have before, and so on and so on. So I am definitely in agreement with Nancy that I do not want to create fear. What I want to create, though, is the truthful recognition of what's going on and to visualize then through a variety of stories the possibility of moving through the challenges of this time and into a positive, promising future.
That's beautiful, Duane. You know, there's one thing I'd like to add to that, which is this. I've seen that the idea that we should simply visualize the positive is too much of an oversimplification. In the end, it doesn't work. There are too many actual factors at play that require us to engage that tend to stimulate fear. That a really mature and integral approach is to get in touch with the miracle of existence and the source of hope and joy and the kind of unbreakable good news that gladdens the heart, and be connected with that, and then fortified by that, have the fortitude to directly face all the things that might stimulate fear, and some of that will temporarily, perhaps at times, stimulate fear or anger or whatever, you know, grieving kinds of emotions. And to be deeply rooted to the good news, the positive perspective, so profoundly that one can face the thing that's difficult, and that people who are only trying to hold the positive over against the negative get overwhelmed when the going gets tough. What we're going to have to deal with in the time ahead is going to require us to be truly profound practitioners of a kind of radical freedom, but also able to engage the relative world and all of its exigencies. And so I feel that it's an expression of my faith and trust and hope that I'm willing to dig in and let it bug me and hurt a little and be afraid at times, because I have so much faith that I can bear to be afraid, and that it's resting on a deep ground of practice, not a failure to intuit the already okayness of things.
Yes. You know, I think we're here to learn. And you don't learn without some really intense life experience. And we're about to learn as an entire species about how to come together and learn together and live together as a human family, and not just as words, but as a reality. And so this is an extraordinary time. It's just unprecedented in human history, the kind of learning opportunity that is now before us. And that can be fearful on the one hand, or it could be an extraordinary, exhilarating opportunity that's just unprecedented. And that's how I'm seeing it.
Well, beautiful. You know, we have quite a few really rich questions that we haven't gotten to yet. I see a few more hands up. Could we go a little bit late, Duane?
Sure.
I know we
sure.
can't go too late, but I'm going to mention that, Grant Hunter in San Jose and Charles in Toronto, both kind of a little differently, are basically saying, we really need to get energized. Where's the integral leadership that provides a concrete new agenda that'll help align so many of us aching for effective change in the world? And saying, if we wait for the story machine to take shape, that may be too late. We need to maybe begin to radically begin to use our cell phones and fax machines and emails and whatever else we have to incite initial healthy discomfort leading to change. So that there are some of us that are really feeling a strong urge toward activism. And then I want to read a particularly moving email, message that we've received from Virginia Sanchez, listening from Mexico, who says, so the new story and new means for producing and spreading the news and the new story, beautiful. But nevertheless, with Rothschild owning Reuters and all the main channels being owned, I think, you know, by other wealthy individuals and corporations, we better get creative fast on the theme of truth and coming up with a new story. I would like us to face the truth of how north-south gap dynamics in the world order is created, and how the U.S.-Mexico relationship is emblematic. I have this vision of enough U.S. seekers and Mexican seekers getting together to come to a common truth, which requires a huge listening capacity from the U.S. seekers. I would love to have a further conversation with you about this. I see that unblocking this creates a planetary domino effect. What are your thoughts?
It's already there. The ability is already there for Mexico and the United States, for any country, to really enter into a dialogue with another country. 25 years ago, in the San Francisco Bay Area, we put on an electronic town meeting. And it was because we came together as a community, and we had a dozen different organizations that cut across all of the different political, different kinds of lines you could imagine. We walked into the ABC television station and said, we are the community. We're not a special interest. We're not just women or environmentalists or business people or whatever. We're the whole range. And we want access to the airwaves, and we want to talk about our future. And we got access. And if we want access as bioregions like the San Francisco Bay Area or whatever, and we want to have a conversation with, say, the Mexico City, or we want to have an entire country have a conversation, we can do it. The technology already exists. The technology exists. It existed decades ago. And what's needed all along is what Grant and Charles were talking about. It's time to get started. We're way past due. And even if we don't immediately have access to the airwaves, we can still get started with community television. This is something I've been doing. I've been using community television. I'm also using just the internet, and so on and so on. And there's no reason we can't have a mass public uprising that says, look, there are new stories for our future. They're positive stories. We're not just against the status quo. We're for something. And it's a new level of localization. It's a new level of freedom. It's a new level of responsibility for our lives and our future. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, Duane, I know we're technically past time. I want to take one live question,
sure.
And it'll have to be real brief.
Okay.
I'm going to respond to someone who's calling in on a line that's identified. You may not be Brian A. Bailey from Upton, Massachusetts, but you're on a line that looks like it, you are. Can you offer a quick question? Introduce yourself. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Benjamin. I am a recent college graduate, and I actually just got back from the Occupy Wall Street in New York.
Oh, great.
And, yeah, it has been quite an experience. There's definitely the bigger, deeper spiritual truths that we've been talking about today missing from that picture. While there are some meditation circles and Om circles, there's also a lot of anger and pain and all of the things that we might expect from that. So my question is kind of, with a lot of people waking up these days and feeling the urgency to help in a heroic way with this transformation and transition of humanity, kind of how you see it unfolding, that we may be able to support each other in order to realize these new dreams and visions. And it's not a very quick question, but I think I wanted to offer that. And also,
well, it's really great also just to hear from somebody who is just, because we are talking about being activists, and you were out there and encountering some of the complexities that we're all grappling with. It's really great to hear your voice, Benjamin. Thanks for asking that question.
Yeah.
I'm going to click off your mic, though, and Duane, please offer an essentialized response.
A brief response.
Yeah.
What if, instead of occupying Wall Street, television stations were being occupied? What if people were saying, it's not what's on television, it's what's not on television? We're not seeing the conversation about climate change. We're not seeing the conversation about species extinction. We're not seeing the conversation about our future. What we're getting is a whole bunch of ads and distraction that's turning us away from attention. What if we shifted our activism to a media activism and said it's time for a new level of conversation as a democracy? Let all voices be heard. Let the Tea Party be heard. Let the progressives be heard. So that's how I feel. I feel that it's time to step up, stand up, and talk back to one another and build a new future.
Well, beautiful. Thank you. There's a lot of folks who've written in some very thoughtful comments. I'll share those with you, Duane. And
great,
I just want to thank you, everyone who's been engaging with us. I'm sorry we have run out of time. Before I open up the lines for us to say goodbye, and I'll also tell you about what's coming up in the weeks ahead, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series. You know, just send out an email to a few of your friends and encourage them. Let them know that you valued this. BeyondAwakeningSeries.com. Please also consider supporting my work and enriching your life by taking my course on integral spiritual practice. You can find out more about that at theispcommunity.com. If you want to learn about Duane's work, go to DuaneElgin.com, DuaneElgin.com. There's a lot of rich resources there. If you want to learn more about my other work and see videos, audios, and other writings, please visit IntegralSpiritualPractice.com. And now, in 2 weeks from today, I'll be talking with neuropsychiatrist Daniel Siegel, who is an expert on interpersonal neurobiology and attachment theory and the mindful brain. And we'll be talking on the changing human story, consciousness, cultural evolution, and the expanded self. Mm-hmm. And then on Thursday, October 27th, I'll be speaking with Bruce Lipton. This is 5:30 p.m. Pacific time, not our regular broadcast time. Bruce Lipton is the author of Spontaneous Evolution and a very dynamic speaker. We'll have more speakers to announce for November and December soon. Okay. Now, I want to open up the phone lines. And those of you on the computers, we won't hear your voice, but those of you who are still on the phone, we can all say goodbye to one another. So it's goodbye, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you and love you.
Thank you.
Thank you and love you.
Thank you.
Love gives something the room to change, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It was wonderful.